to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm a weaver of context, Caroline Casey. The show we're about to hear is one that Susan Griffin and I conversing on the occasion of her 80th birthday, and that was January 26, 2023, was to honor her latest book, Out of Silence, Sound, Out of Nothing, Something, in which she embodied encouraging, soothing, rousing, fierce, gentle mentor of writing craft to all of us who seek to gather our wits, our wonder, and our focus, especially now. When she dies, Pluto in the sky is right on her Mercury, that her voice may continue to resound in pertinent, playful profundity in all of us. As we dive towards midwinter, when Persephone lights her candle to ascend up out of the underworld, and we with her. So we welcome our own customized Persephone, whose book is a guiding candle up out of the underworld. Welcome, Susan Griffin.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Especially and happy you, birthday, Jill. Happy birthday, you wonderful person with seven planets in air. You're like Iris, the rainbow goddess. She can take messages from heaven to the underworld and the underworld back to heaven because she doesn't live either place. Is that fun?
That's really a lot of fun. I love the way, I wish I had that in writing. That's a great description.
Oh, well, we can do that. But yes, and there will be more writing. I'm so grateful to your book and you on your birthday and many things that we want to bring into play for everybody. But you really do run on the fuel of curiosity and wonder, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that fuels me through a lot, much more than certainty.
Because just for the fun of it,
certainty is not part of the. It is not one of the arrows that arrows that writers need in their collection.
Wait. You mean to dissolve the booby prize of certainty?
Yes, that's right.
Right. Yeah, no, that's great. So I can't help but bring in some astrological language because we don't need it, but you speak it without needing to know it, you know, because it's, you speak about, you know, what I often say, Neptune dreams, vision, imagination, to be, you know, as though the backstage ancestors go, look, those humans have run out of certainty, a round of applause, now mystery can find them, right? So it's like, we're available to mystery.
I want to make a distinction. Getting your facts right is an obligation of every writer. You know, not to lie. Lying is a terrible, betrayal of the whole process of communication and expression.
Right. That's so, one of my. It's one of my yellow note cards about your book too, and I have here lying, never lie, and then also no tears, because it steals emotion from the audience. But just for starters, I was also so happy to find out that you, oh admirable mentor, you love index cards. I love index cards.
I love index cards. I love them. You don't too. I love them. I could use up a whole huge storehouse of them because I've taken to just writing everything on them.
Exactly. I mean, I have them. Right. I have them before. Oh, sorry. Yes.
Yeah. Even grocery lists and things, or what you should do today. They're perfect.
No, they're. Yeah, I prefer yellow. Yellow lined paper. Also, you you love that, and I'm like, we are truly sisters. And then there's so many places to go, but yes, no lying, right? That's great. So much of what we love, etymology, again, the words, when we look them up, reveal themselves. You said that truth comes from tree.
Yes. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, it was probably the tree was used as a way to measure in various trading circumstances, because the tree has this straight up and down like a huge ruler.
Yes.
So that's the speculation about it.
And so much of what you love, you speak of archaeology backwards and forwards, you know, but in etymology, like, I also love the word privilege means private law. And we go, there we have it. There, it reveals itself.
That's fantastic. That's great. I didn't know that. That's really great. Yeah.
It's really wonderful. And then you, with your moon and Neptune in Libra, part of your grand trine and air, so says you carry the tradition of women artist metaphor beings, and I just have to say this, and it quintiles your Jupiter in Cancer. Jupiter storytelling is called exalted in Cancer, the providing nutrient, and I didn't initially understand why until I read in the Arabian Nights, where Scheherazade says people need stories more than they need bread.
Yes, it's true, and yes, that's such a wonderful story. It's a story of stories, Scheherazade.
Right.
A story
right.
of the power of stories, and you know, there's this chapter on story in my book in which I quote. Refresh my memory. I can't remember. She's a wonderful Native American writer. Anyway, you know, she traces the origin of language to stories. And it's not that, you know, it's not that stories developed out of language, but that language developed because we needed to tell stories.
Mm. Right. And then our love of etymology and our love of metaphors, you say metaphors are like a short story.
Yes, they are like that, yeah.
In which, you know, time comes... Oh, sorry, yes, you go.
I'm sorry, what?
No, I think we have a little delay. I apologize if I was speaking on top of you. I hand it back to yourself.
Oh, I thought you said something, and I don't know what it was if you asked something. It's okay. You talk.
No, okay. It's gone down the river. but also, you know, exalted. So what I also love and want to admire and encourage, and you've given us a great gift on your birthday, this marvelous book, which is such a good companion. I'm going to have it beside me because you're encouraging our dedication, you know, to our creativity and our Saturn, and then just to say a little and then toss it back to you. but like the best mentors, you guide everyone to their own autonomy. That's the best. And I think the more of us, you know, in-source our Saturn, our authority, it sucks the chi out of authoritarianism in the world because we're no longer outsourcing our authority to sociopathic, cruel dingbats. So to toss back to you just that in that way, writing is magic, and even the deep and often solitary practice to which you're dedicated is good for the world that way, right?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much. You stated so beautifully. And yes, writing is a process of claiming your own authority back. And oftentimes you kind of have to go through the sloth of despond. That's a phrase that came from a poet who fought in World War I and being in those trenches and attacked by shells and ordered to run into a field of bullets produced the sloth of despond. But we have a sloth of despond, I think, in this culture, whether or not you're fighting in trench warfare, and that is, you know, that we've been separated from who we are authentically, from our own impulses, our own knowledge. And so one of the chapters in the early chapters in the book is called Paying Attention. And one way to recover your authentic creativity is to pay attention to what you're thinking, you know, which has often been in particularly if you have a teacher who's also caught in the sloth of despond and doesn't really understand the roots of creativity. You're taught to say what you have been told to say, rather than or to write about or be interested in or pay attention to what you've been told to pay attention to, rather than to where your attention is really going. If you go where your attention is really going, you'll find out that's when creativity begins. You'll find all kinds of explosions of insight and fascination.
And you remind us of reverie and the war on wonder, right? You mentioned, and I resonated with this, being chastised for gazing out the window. It's the Inquisition. I remember my fifth grade teacher, Casey, what are you doing? I go, I'm gazing out the window. I said, I'm thinking, you know. And he thought, I thought you were just gazing. Some of us can do both, which caused me to be sent to the principal's office, for goodness sake. But gazing. Well, remember, the Inquisition is very anti-gazing. And you mentioned that Mary McCarthy says of her friend Hannah Arendt, you bring so many people together here. Hannah Arendt, born on my birthday, or vice versa, she spent hours gazing out the window, staring into space. I'm like, yes, yes, go.
Yes, in modern, you know, late capitalist society, I hope it's late. I don't think it is, but anyway. Every minute is measured for how much profit and loss it brings in. Gazing out the window is a capital punishment, a capital crime.
Right, right. And it is the needed part of us, our inner democracy, you know, to be good inner citizens, outer citizens. Neptune is the part of us that wants that gazing, non-guilty, space out, reverie, music, poetry, uplift, metaphor, you know, and the way, you know, like when we come into a room and forget what we came in to get, etc. It says, no, don't worry about that. It's just underfed Neptune that we can negotiate with. Oh, Neptune, if I, and this is what you're good at too, guiding us to just make some dedications. If I dedicate to having non-guilty reverie, you know, for a time every day, will you give me crisp focus in return? And Neptune goes, yeah, sure. Okay.
That's true. Right, so, yeah. Exactly. You dwell in the haze for a while, and then the clouds start to clear.
Right. Now, do you ever alternate with kind of reverie and then it's interrupted by panic?
Oh, yes, of course.
Good.
When I'm writing, I'm writing away, I'm working on a paragraph, and I get to the end and I'm quite pleased with that, but I want to write more than a paragraph. And then there's maybe someplace I know I have to get to, or maybe I don't know where I'm going. Either way, I'm perplexed. What do I do? And that's when I have to get up and move, because there's wisdom in the body. You know, we think of the brain as the only place where thinking goes on. The whole body thinks. And I'm not saying this metaphorically. It's actually true. The whole nervous system thinks and connects to organs, and the organs think, and the flesh thinks. Flesh and bones think. We're made of the earth. The earth thinks. So this kind of arrogant feeling that somehow nothing else in the universe is thinking is part of what we get bollocked up in. And then we narrow the process of thinking to just ourselves, and then we narrow it within ourselves to be nothing, nothing except what is, akin to mathematics or logic. So... metaphor, for instance, metaphor is shows you how everything in the world is connected. If I use one thing to stand for another, I'm drawing a connection there. We think of it as sensible, right, but it's also real.
Right, and the word metaphor means to carry across. Right, so I love
wonderful. That. I didn't know that. that's great.
Yeah, that metaphors are the incarnational garb whereby power enters the world. Right, so it's like we create this metaphoric template and then invite. You also wonderfully speak about notes, yellow cards, but the first sentence, you know, inviting you to continue if it feels right, that it invites you. So.
Yes. Right. And I suggest to people, go ahead.
No. Sorry, we'll figure this out. Yeah, it's your dance step. I toss it to you. You can toss it back here, whenever you want.
Well, I suggest to people to start out using, in fact, yellow padded paper, you know, those legal pads, they call them. In other words, when you're working on a computer, there's something final about it. You know, you have to print this word in there. It looks like a word in a book, and it's all aligned and everything. Don't start typing on an instrument if you can. Write some notes, write even text on a yellow lined pad, something that you might use for a grocery list and that you might feel inclined to throw out, because you don't want to have this sense of formality constricting you. Finality. You don't want the finality constricting you.
Right.
So there's a lot of trial and error that goes on. You try a sentence. Usually if a sentence comes to you, you don't know where it came from, but you like the sound of it, that's what you want to keep. But then as you're working, your next sentences may not be as good. But don't worry about it. You can change them. You can go back and change them. That's why using a yellow pad encourages you to rewrite and to not look at everything you put down as having to be perfect or the final copy.
Right. The intimacy of the index card, and then you have a great Walt Whitman quote. when you're encouraging everybody to, you know, carry around your cards, carry around your notebook, Walt Whitman says, "By writing at the instant, the very heartbeat of life is caught." It's like, oh, that's really good.
Yes, there are those sentences. Poets are especially aware of that, and I started as a writer, as a poet before anything else. I wrote poetry before I wrote. I made an attempt at a novel, which I write about in the book, which was very sorrowful, very sad, because I didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't really know that the real task of writers is to write, not to be a writer, but to write. So, carrying around a notebook allows you to catch those little fragments of speech that seem to have meaning for you. Like it could be something that came into your head and you don't know where it came from, or it could be words from a song or something someone else said. Sometimes somebody says something, and you say, that's it, and you write it down. Or it amuses you, and you write it down. So catch them, because they're fresh and wonderful.
Well, it's the point you make about metaphors, that time is alive, you know, that metaphors are intrinsically animistic, right? Because everything's now alive. And if everything's alive, we can, you know, cooperate with the thing. And what you say about, you know, notes and our affinity for yellow index cards and yellow lined paper, and then I'm just a step behind you going, and now I'm going to put them together, right? I'm surrounded by yellow, you know, anyway. But, you know, like when I give a talk, I can't do it off of computer type. I need every little scrap of paper that when I had that thought, right? There we go. Cause it's like an intimate little being, right? It's alive that way.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
You know, So you speak of, well, so many things here, but you know, you bring up Mary Oliver and having a faithful, a time to write, a point, a time, even 15 minutes, right? So what do you do, and how might that resonate in each one of us to find our customized time that we could do it?
Well, I used to write in the mornings, and when I can get back to that, it's the most fruitful time for me. But sometimes I can't get to the writing until after I eat. I'm dealing with a couple of, you know, I'm 80 years old now, and I've got some physical conditions that I have to take up a lot of time. That's the worst part of it.
Hmm. Well, yes, it's all, it is all story. All right. And how to language and everything. How do we cooperate? Well, you know, it's part of what you mention about Saturn, without calling it Saturn, you know, our authority, that every kerfuffle And the idea also of having playful words for serious things, right? The kerfuffle, or going to the hoosegow, but may it be, you know, that each kerfuffle be an incentive for us to experiment, and we go, right, and then the small things that you honor, you know. You said that when you were daunted to write, you know, your first book contract, and Adrian Rich said, "Don't write a book, write a paragraph." And it's like just these little small things that make it not daunting, yeah. Right?
And she was writing her first prose book too, but she had started writing it before me. And she said, you know, and this is what she discovered, you know, because poems are sometimes they're book length, but mostly they're. A poem would be considered very long if it goes on for 10 pages, and mostly they're much shorter. So it requires a different kind of feeling to begin to write a prose book, because it's a process that goes on a long time. And if you think of writing the whole book, it can be staggering, like, how can I possibly do that? But you don't do that. You write a paragraph, and that paragraph engenders another paragraph. Or you write a page, and that page may call to the next page, or it may call to the end of the book. You may find that you understand the ending of the book when you write the fifth page, or the 38th page, or the, you know, or the 560th page. So
right.
it's a process which is not predictable, not you can have order such that I will write every day at 11, but you can't order what will happen next. When you think about it, it wouldn't be creative if you could order what will happen next.
Right. Well, this is good, because you're actually doing it. The way I pitch it to myself is to other people, right, is just make a time, you know, and kind of commit to the gods that you'll just show up. You'll just be there. That's all that's wanted, right? And do it three times in a row, and the backstage gods goes, she's done it three times in a row, next time we'll be waiting. But you really do that.
I love that. That's exactly what I tell my students, exactly. And it's what I do.
That's what I tell my students, I haven't done it yet. Okay, but here's you doing it.
But when I come to it, one of those panic moments when I've finished a paragraph or I finished a page and I don't know what comes next, I have to remember that it will eventually come. I get up and I get a cup of tea, and maybe it's come already, or maybe I have to sleep on it for two or three nights. But it does eventually come. And you do go through the slough of despond during that. But that's, you know, that's because we live in this culture that is so intent on constant productivity, profitable productivity, because we are constantly productive.
Well,
I have to
attribute Slough of Despond, because it actually comes from Pilgrim's Progress, I think a 17th century
work.
Oh,
is it really?
Yeah, it's a famous thing. It's Pilgrim, and so the World War One poet is referencing this Slough of Despond. It's a stop on the road, right? The pilgrim must go through it and survive it somehow on their way to heaven.
And that would be like the trench he's calling. He's using that phrase from. That's fantastic. I'm so glad to know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, it's also like when we go through difficult things, and the value of, you know, conversing with others, going, when you did this thing, did this happen to you? Yes, you know. So it's part of the ride, right? You know, on day three of this treatment, did you feel like nobody loved you and you'd made terrible life decisions? And friends go, yeah, exactly. And you go, okay, now that we have the words, then it's almost funny, right? So, okay, day three is Slough of Despond, right? All right, here it's like a Disney ride. Here we go, all right. And knowing that we can kind of get through the thing, but the pause, right? I got to your book and it said take a walk, and it's like, I will, right now. And my dogs do often tell me to turn off the phone, and I have to bow to their higher moral authority. They're like, turn off that thing. Why? So you. We go for a walk without the phone, right? Are you coherently self-possessed because you really don't do that much phone, or online stuff or watch TV?
I do watch TV now because I get very, very tired, and it's a very passive medium. So I do watch TV, but I don't take the phone with me on walks. Definitely not.
Right. Yeah, the creatures, the squirrels would mind, I think that part of the TV and neutrality, you know, is after, well, and I want to go next to Killing the Angel, but having done so much work and you working and or being involved with one's own crises, the TV is like, I want to enter somebody else's story, or the
yes,
world's
exactly.
cataclysm, I prefer detective novels, really, but yeah, there is that. And then, you know,
I love detective programs on television, and I've thought a lot about why that is. It's just all this, solving of a mystery. I love that. And in a way, that is, I think, what you're saying. Somebody else is solving the mystery rather than me, and it's great to watch the process.
Well, but the detective novels are right up there with myth and fairy tale. I think there's a whole thing that I feel connected to on those. but entering somebody else's story and then just briefly, and then we have some minutes, and then we'll have a very short break and come back. But you talk about Killing the Angel, right? And it's like in Buddhism, it says, you know, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. So Killing the Angel, the way you put it, is, you know, at a certain point, you are not the woman tending to everybody else's needs, right? This is part of your...
Actually, that was Virginia Woolf, so I'm quoting her. Yeah, and she wrote an essay about Killing the Angel. And yes, it's the angel is telling women, oh, you should be getting such and such a cup of tea, or you should be making sure... you know, your husband is comfortable in his chair, you know, or you should be making dinner.
Right.
I think modern people have different shoulds, but they're all, you know, basically have an attitude that's very confining.
Right. Well, not
inviting creativity, but the opposite.
Right. Yeah. In modern vernacular, it's put your oxygen mask on first before your children. But also in Psyche and Amor, when Psyche has to go to the underworld to get the beauty ointment for Venus, and it's this terrible ordeal, and she wants to kill herself, and the animals befriend her in the underworld and say, no, don't do that. You know, get in this boat, and here you go. But the boat, when you're in the boat, there will be people drowning all around you. And you must not help them. It's an interesting thing, you know. It's like not always. That would be a terrible thing. But killing the angel. There's a certain point. You know, she's got a mission, and it's just we look at these things and go. Well, sometimes as part of our repertoire, it wouldn't be our default setting. But when creativity is that what you understand?
It's a part of what we were talking about earlier, which is. Creating this alignment with yourself, that you're absolutely aligned with your own thoughts and impulses, and you're reading those, not reading what other people are saying.
Yes. We're going to take a very short break. Our splendiferous guest is a long-dedicated writer, radical feminist philosopher, essayist, novelist, playwright, Susan Griffin. On her 80th birthday, she's given us a great gift, which is her book, Out of Silence, Sound, Out of Nothing, Something. So we want to bless her in return, and we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tallest cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home.
telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our splendiferous ally guest is Susan Griffin today on her 80th birthday, and she has given us a gift, which is her latest book, Out of Silence, Sound, Out of Nothing, Something. It's a guide for people who...
Yes. Well, what we were speaking before about, I was using the phrase alignment with yourself. And this is understanding that we all have many different selves, and this is a self that is very soulful and connected to the world and lives in a world of sound and hears reverberations and echoes. And when you're writing, that's the self you want to be in tune with, literally in tune, like as if you held a tuning fork up to your thoughts and caught with the tuning fork right note.
Ooh, that's so great. Because in your chart, just for fun, you have Jupiter, quintile Neptune, curiosity and wonder. Quintile is a 72-degree angle that makes it possible for you to be a tuning fork. That's what the quintile means, so that you hum, wonder and curiosity in others. And it's so clean and democratic. I know you've written about how we can be good citizens, and this is really part of that, because it's like you don't have to persuade anybody. You're humming in them like a tuning fork, so they go, oh, Susan, since I read your book, I see that now. Right? Direct perception. I love that.
I love that. Great description. That's great. Thanks.
My pleasure, because you write. Symmetrical rhythm is so good that you, as a little girl, used to say, practice. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Or it was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. You said you loved this paragraph and would read it over and over. You said, I was training my ear to take in the music of language. I love that. And then you say, thus, even you, as you write, will be led to the sound of the words you have written toward a wisdom you did not know you had within you. That's beautiful, Susan.
Thank you.
Kipling has... Oh, sorry, yep.
It used to be that, grammar school children especially were taught to learn poems by heart and recite them. But there was something slightly punitive about that. You had to have this, it was kind of learning it. It was not really by heart, but some sort of... test of your memory or something. But if you do learn to recite something by heart, it helps you understand the music of words of language. And I think that we've lost that in our education.
I'm grateful for all the poems I was made to read. The same grumpy fifth grade teacher who, inquisitioned me for gazing out the window, he also did teach us Coleridge's poem in Xanadu Did Kubla Khan, A Stately Pleasure Dome Decree, written completely on opium. So same fifth grade teacher. There we go. But I'm glad to know those lines, right? Kipling has the, when you talk about the musicality of language and the rhythm, I love Kipling says, down to Gehenna or up to the throne, he travels the fastest who travels alone. It's really galloping, right? It's
like, anyway. Beautiful, it is. It's capturing a gallop, yeah. And oftentimes, it's not, I very much doubt that Kipling said, I want to capture a gallop. He was in the gallop himself. He was, when he was writing, he was imagining it. His body was in the gallop, and it produced that rhythm. You know what I mean?
Right.
He was galloping in his mind. In his whole body, he was feeling a gallop.
That's great. I mean, when you're reminding us that the whole body thinks and just go take a little walk and move around the thing and all of that. And then, there's a wonderful deaf drummer, Evelyn Glennie, who's amazing. She performs in big symphonies and other things with bare feet, and she's gone on to do fantastic things. But she says our whole body hears, right? So she can hear through her whole body and through her feet, like elephants. You know?
Oh, that's fantastic. I'd like to get that reference from you. It's marvelous. It's really true. And so I have sometimes even been, when I'm writing a poem or even in prose, to slap against the wall because the rhythm, not so I capture the rhythm, but because it's so strong in me, I have to beat it out somewhere.
Oh, that's great. That's more Saturn, authority, contains the word author, is also rhythm, our own rhythm. That's great, Susan.
When I was a kid, I wanted to learn tap dancing. My grandmother made me take ballet, which was not altogether to my liking, but I was dying to tap dance. Now I do a fake tap dance. I just, imitate tap dancing.
It's adorable. Again, earth, right, as opposed to ballet, up, but also the ways we earth ourselves that you remind us of, and you said, reading out loud, those wonderful, lines, it was the best of times, and it reminded me, I recently got hearing aids, which is quite a trippy thing, and because I was missing some parts of conversation, and the audiologist showed me a little graph of here's the consonants you were missing. But I said to her, I still say what, like what a lot. And she said, you want to spend time reading aloud to yourself because you're training your brain to hear what it had decided it could no longer hear. I'm like, oh, that's deep.
Oh.
Right? Isn't that intriguing? It's a great
really
metaphor
intriguing.
Too. Yeah, it's a great
yes,
metaphor that where have we decided we couldn't hear that or we couldn't think that, and then you can, but to dissolve the internalized prison or the internalized, colonialism or whatever the thing is, unfurl. And I do just want to, it is your birthday. And that is so wonderful. So, whoops, I'm reaching over here. I'm reaching over here for your solar return. Right. So the solar return is pretty much what's going on for us now, but it's for you for a year. And, maybe we can all just sort of animate this, because when you're born, you're the moon and in Libra and Neptune, it is your entire lineage of metaphorical storytelling, artists, women contributing to community. It's like you carry that. And on your solar return, and for us all too, it's the moon in Jupiter in Aries, woof, 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 with Chiron, the entire, history of civilizing, healing, intellect. And it's like, so you get to have that all year. The tradition of woofy women is backing you up, Susan Griffin.
Oh, well, I'm really glad to know that.
Yes, exactly.
It's
and then
great.
just because when we scheduled this due to your fantastically kind and wonderful, publicist Lena, I didn't know, I just picked this date, right? I didn't know this date was your birthday, but then just for fun, your progressed sun, taking each day after you're born as symbolic of a year, is 25 degrees of Aries, which when this station, KPFA, was founded, its sun is 25 degrees of Aries, the image for which is a woman bursting with gifts more than she can hold. So it says, that's you,
and that's
this station.
And that's fantastic. I feel really aligned right now.
Excellent.
No,
it loves you. Yeah, well, that's what you're really encouraging us to and fro, you've distilled so much, and also, you're born on Zelensky's birthday?
No, I didn't know that. I do love him. That's fantastic.
Right. Well, the image for your son, S-U-N, your basic central self, and his is performer in a ritual mystery play. Isn't that fun?
Oh, I love that. Yes.
Yeah. So,
creativity is one of the great mysteries. And it's not only a mystery of human creativity. How does a song arrive, a painting, a poem, even a computer? How does that arrive? We don't really understand. We can mechanically sort of reconstruct, or we can say there's this stage in that, but we don't know why is there evolution? I mean, you know, we sort of get the how, but we don't entirely get the how. We don't entirely get the what or the why. There's mystery in all of it. The nature of the whole universe is creative, and we are creative beings. And it's not only creation to survive. It's creation for the soul to survive, I suppose. But we can't explain any of those mysteries. And it engenders a kind of respect, I think, not to explain it. Because often, think of that phrase, explaining away. I mean, I'm all for explanations. I love to solve mysteries. But on the other hand, you don't want to explain away.
No. No, right. The great Pisces beings like, you know, Einstein and stuff, the more we know, the more wonder. The more we know, the more wonder.
It's
not Harvard.
Yeah.
And you have some... You have some great quotes to remind us. Here's one from David Lynch. You quote him saying, "There's an ocean of consciousness inside each of us, and it's an ocean of solutions. When you dive into that ocean, that consciousness, you enliven it. You don't dive for specific solutions. You dive to enliven that ocean of consciousness." That's a resonant thing for you.
Yeah.
It is, because we all want to be diving for solutions, not specific ones, but we're available, right, to have a culture of ingenious altruism rising up out of this. And you do tell the story of the shoemaker from Grimm's. I think it's Grimm's. It's somewhere between Grimm's and the Arabian Nights. Do you remember that, or shall I start us off? Or?
Yes, I do. I do remember it. Yeah, and I don't know its source, and I may have added to it or changed it slightly. But it's a wonderful story, and it's about this shoemaker who gets a visitation from a sultan, who's a very powerful, wealthy man, and he says, "I want you to make me." And the shoemaker is known to make these really beautifully made leather shoes, and he asked the shoemaker, "Will you make me 1,000 shoes?" And the shoemaker said, "Of course." He said, "All right, I'm going to give you all these bags of gold if you produce them. But if you don't produce them overnight, they have to be done overnight. I'll cut your head off." So the sultan is in this terrible, frightened condition, not unlike the condition that we get in if we have a deadline, or we just want to produce something in a certain amount of time, and we're very frightened, and we get locked and sort of terrified. So we begin working away at it bit by bit. So the shoemaker begins to stitch. That's all he knows. He puts little holes in the various parts of the shoe and starts to stitch. And he does it for a long time. And then in the middle of the night, suddenly the elves come. So the point of that is that just work and the elves will come. You don't have to shout, "Elves,
right,
come."
But
they'll come.
The way you put it also in your wonderful companion book, because the book really is a companion, you say the elves arrive by the invitation of humble craft. Right, and this is such an important.
Yeah.
The invitation is the humble craft, and that's a resonant fairy tale, which is the impossible task, is a fairy tale theme, right? So that's one, you know, make 1,000 pairs of these shoes, says the ruling class, you know, tyrannical dingbat, or I'll cut off your head. So the Elon Musk of that time. You know, more. So right, and so
yes,
that's
and I
great
just
and then
here that
mm-hmm.
The very that there is an analogy here in writing to the shoemaker, you know, slowly doing the threading of the needle through the leather, and that is many times when I'm working editing somebody's paragraph and they want to throw the whole paragraph out, or they're upset about it, it's not good enough, and I say, wait a minute, and I tinker, and I show them that the paragraph is really has this superb possibility within it, but you have to tinker. You have to play with the words and get them, you know, get this clause in the right position. This verb is not the right verb. You haven't ended the paragraph with the real ending. The ending you have somewhere in the middle, bring it over to the end. So you do all these things and suddenly it shines. But you have to do that. You have to tinker
That's
with
great.
Ending. Most
That's
writers
great.
Say that real writing is rewriting.
Yes, that's wonderful. And the tinker, of course, is the shoemaker, and he's making leather shoes, which is important, which, again, ground us to the earth. Oh, that's super great. Yeah, and yeah. and the generic impossible task, the villain says to the young maiden, you know, separate these poppy seeds from these sesame seeds by morning or, you know, death, right? And she can't do it. Right, and she
yes.
weeps.
Yes, I love that.
And then the ants come forth and they go, "You were very kind to us when nobody else was," which is also an important theme, right? You were very kind to us. You treated us with respect when nobody else did. So we'll help you. And so the ants come and they sip through the thing. But your point being, the humble craft will invite the capacity to do the impossible thing, you know. And that's right.
That's
part of the. It's part of the mythology of mentors, right? And your beautiful Chiron planetoid mentor, right next to your North Node, your life work, well, many life works, but to be mentor. And so, Chiron starts a school for future cultural heroes, and all their tasks are impossible, but they always succeed when they study with Chiron. So it tells to us and to you and to your audience. Impossible things, right, can be done if we study with Chiron, have a mentor, be a mentor. So, yeah,
and
doing
then
impossible
it's also
things.
That story of and what is it? The story of the turtle and the hare. Is it they're in this race?
Yes, this is going to be Aesop, though. I find Aesop's almost always a moralistic downer. But carry on.
But even so, this one is a good one, I think. You know that the turtle finishes the race. You know, and so slow but steady is a very good slogan to remember.
Yes, but right, and certainly better than the grasshopper and the ant, which is extremely moralistic. And
I hate that one. Yeah, that's
right.
Because moralistic.
Right, yeah. Well, because we're all, many of us here are grasshoppers and, you know, are,
yes.
Anyway, why don't you just settle down
yeah.
and get it? But, and just to honor, you know, here you are, Susan Griffin, on your fantastic 80th birthday. You were born in 1943, the year of the water horse. And in China, they didn't want girl babies born in the year of the water horse or dragons, because they were too much trouble. So, you picked the right spot.
Oh, great. I'd love to know that. That's great.
Right. But also, you know, in hearing your narrative about, you know, the hardship of your young life, you know, it really is as though part of you sort of backstage said, I'll go to that beautiful planet with no Earth signs, you know, as though you go, fantastic planet, strange human customs, land me in circumstances where I will know everything that needs healing. Like, we have an opening in Los Angeles. Here you go, because you really raised yourself, right?
Well, I had, when you get older, you look back at your past, and there's a sort of softening of the gaze, and it's not like you're getting less, you're getting less judgmental in along certain groove lines, and I'm starting to see all the help I was getting as a child. My parents' divorce, my mother's alcoholism created terrible pain in my life, and I don't minimize that at all. But I was also, I had my sister who loved poetry and gave me early lessons, really, in poetry. we used to scour the bookstores in Los Angeles, and I found first editions when I was just 10 years old. You know, I started with that. And my father would take me anywhere I wanted to go that I was in. I got interested in painting for a while, thought I'd be a painter, and he'd take me to whatever show was on at the museum. I especially remember one that was Van Gogh in the 50s. And, you know, I had some wonderful teachers, too. The Los Angeles City school system was very good in that period. So, and then I had my adopted parents to whom the book is dedicated. And they gave me an enormous background and understanding of how it is to make a life as a writer and an artist, which is not always easy because our culture doesn't give very much financial support to art. We think somebody's famous, they make a lot of money. Not so if you're a writer or most painters. Some of them make a lot of money, but most of them don't.
No. There's a fantastic satirical New Yorker short story by some smart grumpy British guy, but in which he reverses the status of movies and poems, right? So Hollywood's all based around poetry, right? And people, you know, making movies are in small, tiny, underfunded clubs. And so anyway, it's very witty.
That's
funny. Sonnet.
And I just need to, because of my filmmaker friends, I need to add to that a lot of filmmakers don't make any money at all. And not only do they not make any money, they have to raise huge amounts of money to finance the medium. So it's only the Hollywood stars that make huge salaries. And
right.
And that's the luck of the draw.
Right. And Martin Amis is nowhere near as nuanced as you. But there's many great things that you again proffer. And I really find this book and reconnecting with your wonderful self, just the right timing going, oh, I needed this reminder. Right. That, 'cause it is, you're very encouraging and, you know, on your birthday, we just want to everyone send, you know, appreciation. To your liberating dedication and thank you, and then just things I'm still surrounded by, you know, index cards here from your work. I'll just be random, but you quote Alice McDermott
that craft is also terribly important, and that you find out what you're thinking through craft. So I wouldn't just spew for pages and pages, maybe spew for a paragraph and then employ your craft, and it's the craft because craft has generations of knowledge within it. It's developed over time. When you get any rhythm, you're in tune with a whole orchestra, a whole band of people who've been drumming and fiddling for generations and generations, and you're just the last notes in that song as far as you're concerned with that piece of music. And that it's mainly I'm talking about music, but any sort of craft, the craft of getting a sentence to be clear, will help you clarify your thought. In other words, it's not that you know something already and you're very good at expressing things clearly all the time. Just as often, you have a feeling about it. You're sort of in the general vicinity, but you don't know quite how to express what it is you're sensing. And then you craft it and you search for the right words and you balance the sentence, and then suddenly you've taught yourself what it is that you were trying to reach.
That's great. No, and the idea of resonating when we focus, resonating with the entire tradition of everyone behind us who's done that. Yeah, our great ally, Max Dashew, wonderful person, reminds us that the word craft means power from dedication. So it is one of the most... Yeah, so we can stick it, you know, behind you. We can stick it behind your name on your birthday, Susan Griffin Craft. you know, writing craft, Susan Griffin Craft. You know, whatever we want, Rumi Craft. Yeah, I was pleased the other day to be quoting Brer Rabbit and Rumi, going, "Oh, Brer Rabbit, Rumi, let's put them together." But so we're deconvening. I love that you also said. It's Adrienne Rich again, but she says, beginning invites you to continue, but anything goes as long as you don't bore yourself.
Yes, actually, I'm not sure that Adrian said that. That's mine, I believe.
Oh, that's you. Let's give it back to you.
Yeah.
We like attribution.
And it's very important that you don't blame yourself for boredom, or you know, in other words, when you're boring yourself, pay attention to that, and find out why you're boring yourself or what you're bored. Take it seriously as a condition. We're bored so often in this culture with all these long bureaucratic forms we have to fill out, and the educational system can be that way, and many of the exchange with official people can be that way. So don't tolerate boredom. Don't tolerate it. Go beyond your boredom. Don't bore yourself. Usually when you're boring yourself, you're being very conventional.
We have been listening to a show with Susan Griffin, who was born January 26, 1943, and departed this life September 30th, 2025. Her friends write, "In lieu of flowers, admirers might best honor her by reading one of her books or by working to protect the fragile commons, the earth, and the dignity of those most at risk that she spent her life defending." Context, Caroline Casey, as we head into the unfurling conflagration in every world. So we resume our anarcho-entheo-astro-animism facing global